How did the farm boy from Sorel become a cine cameraman?
Oh, that was by accident, really. And I wanted to leave school, like all boys in their teens. I wanted to get out of school. I had a good friend who was working for the Tasmanian Government Photographic Laboratory, as it was called then. It later became the Tasmanian Government Photographic Laboratory and Film Unit. Later became, I think, the Tasmanian Film Production Unit. However, at this time it was basically a still photographic unit with doing a little bit of movie work. And a job as an office boy became vacant there. And my friend said, "Do you want to be a photographer?" And I said, "Sure, anything to get out of school." So I became the office boy, and very quickly, there wasn't enough work to do in the office, actually. And I quickly became a darkroom hand, and then later a photographer, still photographer. It was very good training, because as a still photographer, you had to do your own processing of the films, your own printing of the photographs, which I preferred to do anyway. And later still, when there was more movie work to do, propaganda work for the government, training films and some propaganda films, we did movie work. So then later it was almost exclusively movie work. Of course, a lot of strange things happened. It was very boring for a good part of it, but I found it very interesting, and was at least some variety. Sometimes it could be marvellously funny, except that you couldn't take advantage of the humour at the time. I will remember filming, I'm not certain whether it was for Newsreel or possibly early television for Sydney. I don't think television was then going in Tasmania, but anyway, it was television film. When a new governor had been appointed to Tasmania, his name was Sir Charles Gardner. He was due to arrive at the airport to be met by the administrator, the acting governor at the time, who was the Chief Justice, Sir Stanley Burberry. Well, Sir Stanley had a stiff leg, and which he handled very well, but everybody knew about it, was nothing peculiar. However, the airplane arrived, and down the steps came Sir Charles Gardner. Sir Stan, with his stiff leg swinging out in good fashion, strode out to meet Sir Charles Gardner. It was quite apparent that Sir Charles Gardner also had a wooden leg, at least a stiff leg. I guess it was a wooden leg. And so the two with the stiff legs met. Then they met the government, the cabinet of the day, the Tasmanian cabinet. About third in line was a government minister. I think his name was Mr. Connolly. And each minister stepped forward to meet the new governor introduced by Sir Stanley Burberry. So along came Sir Stanley with his stiff leg, introducing stiff-legged Sir Charles Gardner to Mr. Connolly, I believe it was, who took his two paces forward to shake hands, and he had a stiff leg. And by this time, I mean, it was getting a bit out of hand, and fortunately, we could go off to Government House, where we were to take more film, was to take the arrival of the governor at Government House. His staff was already ensconced in Government House, a very nice old castle-like place with gardens, including two Labrador dogs, two lovely dogs, which we later saw a lot of. The governor was very fond of them, and they'd already were housed at Government House, and they were given full run there. And so the idea was that we'd go off to Government House quickly, preceding the governor, and again film Sir Stanley Burberry as governor, or the occupant of Government House, meeting the incoming governor. So we did that. He arrived, and two of their stiff legs went swinging up into Government House, up the steps. Then we asked them, "Could we please come out into the gardens and take some more film? We wanted some more film to show the governor relaxing and in the gardens of Government House, very picturesque." And we believed that he had dogs, which he liked very much, and that sort of thing. So they agreed. So 5 minutes later, they came and appeared at an entrance into the garden, which was very pretty. Sir Stanley, with his stiff leg, chatting in very friendly fashion with Sir Charles Gardner, who was a very nice man, with his stiff leg, accompanied by his favourite dog, the older one, who had a very, very pronounced limp. And that just broke everybody up after everything else. And there was nothing we could do about it. And we all broke up, and Sir Stanley kept himself in check pretty much because he really didn't want to break up. But dear old Sir Charles Gardner saw the funny side of it, and it was all okay. So a lot of those things would happen. I remember going flying with a man named Vern Reed. Vern would do all sorts of marvellous things, like fly low where he maybe wasn't supposed to, but he was a very good pilot to have flying for you when you were filming. Vern had also adapted a small plane, something like a Tiger Moth, I think it was. So he'd adapted this Tiger Moth to a seaplane. He had put sea floats on it. And I was then working for, I'd left the government, Tasmanian government, and I was the only cameraman for ABC television in Hobart. And a substantial ship, had got into difficulties off the coast of Tasmania and was being towed by another freighter into Hobart, into the harbour, across Storm Bay, and it was quite rough. Of course, it sometimes was quite rough, but it wasn't too rough on this day. So we wanted to get film before the commercial station. There was even some competition between the ABC and the commercial station there at the time. And so the one way we could get it would be to fly very low and perhaps land in the water. We did both those things. Vern Reed agreed to do it, and I took film, swung around there only a few feet off the water and got some nice film of this disabled freighter listing over and being towed. And then he landed right in front of the two freighters and got them steaming past from water level, which was also very good. So we got back into the plane. I was standing on the floats, and Vern was too, and we got back in. The damn plane wouldn't start. the tide was going the other way. We were drifting across Storm Bay. We were fortunately, only about half a mile from the shore, except that the current wasn't taking us to the shore. It was taking us right out into Storm Bay, and that can be awfully rough and no good to be in a disabled float plane. And I said to Vern, well, what are we going to do? Get on the radio? He said, no, we can't get on the radio. He said, we're not even allowed to land here. I'm not allowed to do this. The Civil Aviation will take my license. And I said, well, we're not going to go out into Storm Bay. Can't we do something? And can we paddle it? He said, no, there's no paddles or anything. And I said, we'll have to get over and tow. He said, I can't swim. And I said, well, it was August. I well remember it was August. It's just the end of winter, and I hadn't been swimming for several months, and I knew it was damn cold. And he said, can you swim? And I said, all right, I'll swim. So he fortunately had some rope, and I put it round my shoulders, round my neck a little, in a sort of into a rough harness, and got out and swam towards the shore. But I was going cross current, and every time I'd stop, the weight of the plane swinging at an angle away from me would drag me under. So I had to keep swimming, and I swam for about at least an hour and a half to 2 hours. I could only make it cross current, you see, and I did get the plane in onto the beach, and where we walked for 5 or 6 miles and then got a ride back into the city. And I never did that was a better story of the day, but of course nobody was able to use it, because we'd promised faithfully that we wouldn't dob Vern in, and so we didn't, although the ABC chief of staff in the newsroom knew about it and dearly wanted to use it as a nice sequence to the story, but of course couldn't, and never did it, never came out, and so Vern didn't lose his license. So not terribly exciting, but that was one of the more exciting coverages in Tasmania. Of course, Vern was very grateful, and I suppose it's one of the most sincere compliments, one that I accepted at the time and still do, as being a very sincere compliment, came from Vern after that. He said, "You're one of the great men, boy, and you're going to appear in my book. When I write my book, the great men I have known, you will be high on the list. You will be right in there." That was because, first of all, I'd saved his seaplane, and secondly, of course, I didn't report him to the Department of Civil Aviation. So I may appear in Verne's book if he ever writes it.
Neil, how long did you stay in Tasmania filming for various organisations?
Well, our total working years there was about 13. And the last 3 years were with the Australian Broadcasting Commission, ABC Television, and I was the first and only cameraman for a year or two. Later there was an assistant.
But what are the years involved here? You started in...
I started with the ABC in early 1961 and left them very early, 1964, so I was 3 years with them. Of course, I thought that I would probably stay in Hobart or maybe go to work in Sydney or Melbourne somewhere, although I always wanted to move out and do other things, move out anywhere. I remember looking at a job vacancy in Uganda once. I'm probably lucky I didn't go there. That was with the United Nations as a cameraman for the United Nations at that time in Uganda. But there weren't too many jobs going at that time in the international field. But in about 1962, I guess, the ABC were doing a series of short feature films on the towns and cities of Australia. They'd called it A Town Like. Of course, the first one was a Town Like Alice. Then there was A Town Like Sydney, A Town Like Darwin. They did a series of which there were 12 towns. There was only one done in Tasmania, and that was a town like Port Arthur, which is completely government-owned, and except for one building in it, which is the policeman's house, is all convict-built, and always as it was, built by the convicts. So we did a film on Port Arthur, which was very successful. Of course, the someone high in the ABC News at that time, Keith Fraser, who subsequently went much higher, he was in ABC Television. He came down to direct this film. Of course, Keith didn't know anything about film at all, and he was rather putting his reputation on the line. So he did a very wise thing, I must say. He appealed to the cameraman, which was me. He said, "Look, I don't know anything about this, so you go ahead and do it. And it'll be all fine." I said, "Fine," which suited me. I didn't want somebody who didn't know anything about film trying to direct and then subsequently messing it up. I was much happier with Keith to have a nice holiday at Port Arthur as I did the film, which is the way it turned out. Of course, I didn't tell anybody about this, and the film was very successful. It was of the 12 films in that series, it was second only to Sydney. It ran the second longest time. It was very successful. And Keith, of course, was the director. And lots of people were amazed that Keith had managed to direct this fine film. But I never said anything about it, and Keith was forever grateful about it. Well, then, at the end, towards the end of 1963, the largest television news film company in the world, which was Viz News, based in London, of which the BBC and ABC and Reuters News Agency were shareholders, advertised for a cameraman to work in Southeast Asia. At that time, as the ABC were shareholders and they thought it would better to be an Australian, they asked, well, the ABC, as shareholders, were asked to select an Australian cameraman because they thought that an Australian passport holder would probably do better in that area. At that time, the British weren't in very good graces of Indonesia and a couple of other countries. And the position was advertised in Australia very widely through the ABC. I was one of a number of applicants for the job. And sitting on the selection board were three people from the ABC, including Keith Fraser, the man who had directed the Port Arthur film. And he was always very grateful to me, as I say. He lived on the Port Arthur film for a long time. And when my name came up, of course, he said, "I know this man, of course, a very fine cameraman, shot the Port Arthur film for me." And they had no strong feelings about any of the other applicants. I don't even know who they were. There were several, but I don't know. And therefore, but Keith had, his strong recommendation was his cameraman from down in Tasmania. And that's how I moved out of Tasmania and directly to Southeast Asia.
What was your first assignment there?
My first assignment was to go to the jungles of Borneo with the Gurkha troops. Malaysian Borneo at the time was being confronted, or all of Malaysia was being confronted, was the word that was used, by President Sukarno's Indonesian confrontation, it was called. The British troops, including Gurkha troops, were fighting in Borneo and were positioned along almost 1,000 miles of very, very deep jungle. And I covered that for several weeks, also with Malaysian troops. And that was my introduction to war, I suppose. There wasn't very much fighting, actually. I never did take film of an engagement there. I was on the spot quickly after one or two. But there was very little fighting, you know. There was just a clash now and again.
It was a curious war, that, wasn't it? In a way, I've often called it the last of the fun wars, you know, particularly for the British who were fighting, doing most of the opposition to confrontation.
Correct. There were far less than 100 killed on the British-Malaysian side. The poor Indonesians suffered a bit more because they had a couple of horrendous experiences in the jungle of Borneo. I know 120 tried to get through the mangrove swamps in northern Borneo. They didn't cause the British any trouble because when the remnants finally got through, they amounted to, I think, 7. Well over 100 had died in the mangrove swamps, which were awful.
Well, that's hardly fun, but I mean, the way the British Army operated with their lines of supply and their jungle bases, and it was pretty stirring stuff for them, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. It was. They loved it because it was the last time they could really feel they were engaged in something. And they loved working with the natives, as they called them. They loved working with the natives and using the natives. And they did do it rather well, actually. And it was how the Americans should have done it. But they did it very well, and they didn't lose many people. And the Indonesians, generally speaking, apart from a couple of bad experiences, also didn't lose many people, and they were really never terribly serious about it. It was never a war and an invasion. It was never that was never attempted, and they never really seriously considered it.
Historically, it was grandstanding by Sukarno, wasn't it? I mean,
yes, of course it was. It was to draw attention to the fact that Malaysia was a brainchild of the British. That may or may not have been true, but he considered it was, and that the British were there as neo-colonialists, and he wanted to draw attention to it. What it did, in fact, do was to consolidate Malaysia as a nation. If he hadn't have actually confronted them, there may have been serious problems within Malaysia. There were serious problems developed later when Singapore withdrew from Malaysia, but with Sukarno's confrontation, Singapore remained very solidly in Malaysia during the confrontation, and the Borneo states remained very solidly within Malaysia, whereas there may have been problems with those three states earlier on, but Sukarno's confrontation actually solidified the whole concept, and Malaysia became a nation because of it.
From what you say, though, I gather that your interest in the area and in the story far transcended going around taking action film.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I had immediately seemed to reach a rapport with most Asian people. I had I won't say an understanding, but I attempted to understand their point of view, and their attitude and the way they approached life, I found, generally speaking, was very commendable. And it didn't differ greatly whether they were Indonesians or Malay or Vietnamese, where I subsequently met, of course, very early in my time in Asia. or the Filipinos, or Cambodia, or Thailand. They all more or less had an idea of life, which was that life was precious and life was to be lived. And their philosophy was also very strongly embedded in family loyalties and in compassion. I found most Asians are very, very compassionate people.
And more so than your brother Westerners?
Yes, I'm afraid so. And that in the past has not been generally accepted. Generally, it's the opposite idea, is that life means very little to them, and the inscrutable Asian. I've never seen an inscrutable Asian, actually. Their feelings are only too obvious, I find, most times. And their compassion and their understanding for their fellow man or woman in times of great stress, particularly war and everything that goes with it, which they've experienced greatly, not only in the past few years but in throughout history, their understanding and compassion far exceeds that of the Westerner, I believe. A Westerner may have patriotic feelings for his country, but that is usually a selfish attitude to keep his way of life and to consolidate the Western way of life, which traditionally has been to take advantage of the poorer and the developed countries of the world, particularly in Asia and in Africa. And in warfare itself, I found a great understanding and a great compassion and heroism with the Asian soldiers, which generally far exceeded the Western soldiers. And their understanding and compassion for wounded or dead Westerners was far greater than the Westerners' compassion for dead Asians. In fact, it was something that could only be described usually as sinful was the American attitude towards the dead Asians, whether they were dead soldiers on either side or dead civilians. They had no really strong feelings of compassion, and that always shocked me a great deal, whereas with the Asian people it was not so at all.
But a death was a death, whether you were Westerner or you were...
Yes, a death was a very sad thing. They handled it better, but they showed great respect for the dead and for the people whom it affected, the living whom it affected. And they at the same time accepted it much better because they had been exposed to it much more often, exposed to violent death, exposed to the uprooting of their whole society and their whole way of life, and they'd been refugees over and over, many of them. And they were able to accept everything much better, much in the way that my community back home in Tasmania, my farming community, accepted everything that came to pass, life and death. They didn't become hysterical about things, but at the same time, they also were more compassionate and understanding towards people who were suffering, either the living or the dead.
Could it be said, though, that by the time you'd gone through this Borneo experience and taken your news film of this conflict and associated with certainly the people who live in Borneo and Chinese and Singapore and Malaysians and so on, that Asia had become something very important to you?
Yes, it had become important because I found I could identify, and also because I quickly built up a lot of friendships, a lot of close friendships, particularly in Indochina, in Vietnam, and Laos and Cambodia later, but in Vietnam mainly at that time. Of course, those friendships were strong and lasting, and I do admit that it was under extraordinary circumstances, because in times of war and in times of stress, what you share with people at that time tends to build a much more binding and much stronger relationship, simply because you and they have been exposed to the same stresses, and so you've seen how they've reacted towards you and towards within themselves and towards other people. Therefore, small things about people that may irritate you, you dismiss, because when it comes to the big things, they perform very, very well. And fortunately, I find that in those situations, the very, very strong majority, a very big majority of people act very well. People are naturally courageous. I don't mean to say that they have to go out under heavy fire and rescue the maiden or anything else, but under great stress and under fire and under attack and times when everything seems lost and you're facing death, people generally perform very courageously, with great courage. And I found that over and over again.
Are you saying more so in the Asian context than in the European context?
I think so. I won't say that about the Australian soldiers, simply because for a start I didn't spend enough time with them, and they were very well trained. I think perhaps they performed very well, and they certainly performed in the field quite well most of the time. But the Americans, for instance, of whom I had a lot of contact with, and there were 500,000 American soldiers there, quite often performed quite badly. And I think this was not because they were trained badly, it's because their upbringing in America and their training in the army, I don't mean the physical training, but the their indoctrination, if you want to call it that way, was not good. But mainly, it gets, I think, back to their childhoods, and remembering that the American soldiers generally were the underprivileged. They were drafted because they were not university students, because they didn't have jobs and things like that. So they came from slums, and they were over proportion of blacks, and they were the underprivileged in America. But they certainly didn't act very well, because under stress they would not perform great heroics. They would perform very selfishly, usually.
But the less trained Asians would behave vastly differently.
Yes, and a lot of the Asians were barely trained at all. A lot of the Asians were not trained militarily. They got their training in the field. Some of them got no more than 15 days training. Anyone had 6 weeks training, that was considered a well-trained soldier. But it was their basic training in their homes and in their societies as they came up. They therefore acted much, much better under stress, much, much better. Americans acted very, very badly quite a lot of the time. There were some well-trained military units who acted quite bravely, but they didn't, and rarely saw them act with compassion, although there are some exceptions to that.